You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
In 1946, there was a movie directed by Frank Capra starring Jimmy Stewart. He played the role of George Bailey, and the movie was called... Thank you so much. That movie is on the cutting edge of post-World War II. It is 79 years old, and I just thought to myself, that's the way I'm going to open the conference. And I just thought, most people weren't born when that movie came out. Anyways, in the film, Jimmy Stewart, George Bailey, went through and had an experience of seeing the town in which he lived corrupted because he didn't live in it. And the place was called Pottersville, after the villain. And there were pawn shops and strip clubs and everything that was just vile and corrupt in the 1940s. And Stewart's face right there captures it all. This town was toast. But what you didn't notice is one of the primary reasons that Stewart felt so shocked looking into the moral abyss was that they were doing the jitterbug. That's how you know that the social fabric is ripped apart indelibly. If people are doing the jitterbug. Now, some of you are like, what's the jitterbug? Do you know what you want to see what the jitterbug is? All right, let's check it out. I'm so glad you laughed. I really am. I'm so glad. The jitterbug. That was this thing that really showed things were falling off the rails. What we want to do here tonight is actually look at a different question, but this serves as really a good analog to what we're trying to get at. Not, what if George Bailey didn't live in his hometown, but what if Jesus of Nazareth never lived? What effect would that have, not just on a town, but on the entirety of the world for the last 20 centuries? To do this, what we need to do is to climb into the minds and the mindset of an ancient milieu, a cultural backdrop, philosophically, morally, religiously. And what we're going to try and do is grasp what it would have been like to be in the world that was present during Jesus' day and antecedent to Jesus' day. Let's begin with the idea of human personhood. What does that mean? Individualism, free will, free choice, moral values, equality, human rights. What did these things look like before Jesus of Nazareth hit the scene in the first century AD? Plato, the great Greek philosopher, said this in the Republic: there is nothing more ruinous to a state than the equality of those who are unequal. What Plato saw and what we don't see through modern lenses is that people are patently unequal. Patently unequal. Here's the late Larry Zeidendaub. He was a political philosopher. He wrote this: the Greek conception of nature did not at first make any sharp distinction between nature, phusis, and culture, nomos, between the cosmos and the social order. You see what he's saying? Don't lose me here. Don't lose me. He's saying looking out at the cosmos and then looking inward at the social order, there was no line that was breaking those apart. Everything was all part of the all. Everything was being smushed together philosophically. So he writes this. He says, binding them together was the assumption, the presupposition in the ancient world of natural inequality. My friends and I have this perennial debate. there is a debate over who is the greatest basketball player of all time. I don't think it's ever going to be solved, okay? But we debate it over and over and over. Is it Michael? Is it LeBron? Is it Bird? Is it Magic? Is it Chamberlain? Is it Russell? No one says Olajuwon, but you know what I mean? You get the idea, right? In this debate, when you look at these different players, we have argued about it for years. Who is the GOAT? Who is the greatest? And you know what I've never heard in all of the time that we've debated this? I've never heard one of my friends say, they're all equal. Why not? Because if you take two of these players and you look at one statistic, pick your statistic, I don't care, points per game, blocks, steals, field goal percentage, three-point shots, anything, height, speed, agility, intelligence, any metric, any statistic in any two players, they are not going to be equal on even one statistic. Now, you might be asking yourself at this point, where am I going with this? Take any two people in this room and put them against any metric, and you will see that they are obviously unequal. Some are taller, some are shorter, some are smarter, some are more adept in business, some are more adept in science, some are more, you can go right on down the line. Any metric you pick, you're going to have two people, one metric, and it's not going to be the same. So what Plato knew, and what Seneca knew, and what the ancients knew, is that people are not equal. Now just imagine, you are a Greek person living in AD 150. And you walk up to a sweet Christian woman, and she says to you, there is an infinite personal God. Not like Zeus, not like Hera, not like Apollos, not like superhuman gods, like Marvel characters, you know what I mean? They urinate and defecate, and Zeus tricks women to sleeping with them, and Hera tries to kill Achilles, and you know, right on down the line. They're imperfect, flawed gods. I'm not talking about that. I am speaking of the infinite personal God. In the words of the psalmist, Psalm 147, his knowledge is infinite. Psalm 33, he spoke and the universe was created. All powerful, all knowing, and the locus of goodness, of love. This God exists. And according to this God, you are his work of art, fearfully and wonderfully made. In the words of Paul, Ephesians 2:10, you are his poema. You know where that word translates later? Poetry. You're his masterpiece. She says, you have inherent dignity and equality. You don't get your value from your family, from your social tribe, from your polis, from your city-state, from your nation. You get your value, in the words of Seidenthal, because you have a direct individual access to the deepest reality that there is, which is a relationship with the infinite personal God. Now that's individualism. Value as an individual, not just as an amorphous mass of humanity. You are not just God's plaything, his slave. You're his son. You're his daughter. And it's not so much that you know God in Galatians 4. He knows you. You know, it doesn't matter if I know someone who's famous. It matters if they know me by name. It's not that I know God. It's God knows my name. God has a place prepared for me. Your life has significance beyond anything you could possibly understand or grasp. There's going to come a moment in the future where you stand before God and he's going to say, well done, good and faithful servant, come in here. There's so much joy, so much love, and it's going to be like this forever. Can you even imagine the reaction that would have on an individual living under the auspices and the ideas of a first century world? Human personhood. Well, how did this play itself out in the world? Well, infants and children were treated like trash. Let's read Plato, 4th century BC. Of all animals, not a good start, of all animals, it is the child who is, quote, the most intractable. It is a treacherous, sly, and most insolent creature. Cicero, Roman statesman, 100 years before Jesus. The thing itself cannot be praised, the child, the thing, the child. Only its potential. It's not a valuable being made in the image of God, only what it could potentially become. Consequently, quote, deformed infants shall be killed. And I'm going to try to make this PG-13. I'm going to try and be as clinical as I can. I will say I am restraining myself with the literature in the ancient world. It gets dark quickly. But I'm going to try and be as clinical as possible. This will be PG-13, though, all right? Seneca, Roman philosopher, contemporary of the apostles. He writes, "We drowned children who are at birth weakly and abnormal." Plutarch, during the time of the apostles. Quote, "Until the umbilical cord comes off, the child is more like a plant than an animal." Indeed, up until the eighth day, a Roman father could choose to put the baby out for exposure. Here is a letter that was discovered in the 1970s in Oxyrhynchus, Egypt. Cache of papyri letters that were found there. This particular letter dates to 1 BC, so Jesus would have been a toddler at this point, probably born 4 or 5 BC. I know that's weird, before Christ. He was born 4 to 5 years before himself, but that's the way it is. Hilarion, this Egyptian soldier, was writing to his wife. And in this letter, we see the tender heart of a loving husband. And I'm not being facetious. Ready? He writes this, "Know that we are still in Alexandria. Do not be anxious. If they go home, I will remain in Alexandria. I beg and entreat you, take care of the little one. And as soon as we receive our pay, I will send it up to you. Honey, I got a paycheck. I'm taking care of you. Don't be worried. Don't be anxious. My money's coming your direction." And then he writes this, "If by chance you bear a child, if it is a boy, let it be. If it is a girl, cast it out." Expose it. Put it on the rubbish heap to die. In the ancient world, this wouldn't have made the news. Today, if this happened, it would be all on the front pages of the newspaper. Now, I want to be clear. This man has the ability to show tenderness to his wife. But here we see very clearly just a large missing piece in his ethics. Girls don't have value. Do you know what the most dangerous three words to hear in the ancient world were? It's a girl. Maybe you've had that moment of being in the waiting room and you hear those words and you spring up with delight. In the ancient world, as a young mother, and you heard, "It's a girl," that would be the most dangerous thing you ever heard. Tom Holland, very, very interesting character. Agnostic, not a believer in God. He's a historian. But he wrote this book called Dominion. And the subtitle is, "How the Christian Revolution Remade the World." Holland loves the Greco-Roman world. He fell in love with the ancient gods. And yet, the more he read it, the more he said, "I have nothing in common with these people." And it bothered him. And he wrote this 600-page book to try and synthesize how he was feeling about all this. Why do I value children? Why do I value persons? Why do I believe in human rights when all of these people whom I study don't? Here's what he writes. Across the Roman world, wailing at the sides of roads, on rubbish tips, babies abandoned by their parents were a common sight. Others might be dropped down drains. They're to perish in the hundreds. The odd, eccentric philosopher aside, few had ever questioned this practice. Girls, in particular, were liable to be winnowed ruthlessly. Those who were rescued from the wayside would invariably be raised as slaves, and brothels were full of women who, as infants, had been abandoned by their parents. Their hope was being rescued from exposure, esposito. It was the word, the term used in Latin. You would expose them, and their hope was to be rescued to be a slave or a prostitute. Pretty much everyone else had always taken it for granted until the emergence of Christian people. Here is O.M. Backe. He's a Norwegian historian. This is from his book, When Children Became People. Many infants were rescued. Good. They were rescued. Sounds great. We're off to a good start. Many infants were rescued at periods when there was a great demand for slaves. And most foundlings, in fact, ended up as slaves and frequently also as prostitutes. Justin Martyr, the Christian apologist in AD 150, said in his dialogue with, in his first apology, he said that most children that were abandoned and exposed, they ended up becoming prostitutes. Clement of Alexandria, AD 215, he said that the boys were beautified before they were sold as slaves. Backe refers to this sewer that was uncovered in Ashkelon, and his colleague, Lauren Stager, excavated this sewer. So we read this. When we excavated the dry, sieved, and desiccated sewage, we found the bones of nearly 100 little babies apparently murdered and thrown into the sewer. In modern vernacular, they were flushed. Holland, I can't verify this, but Holland, who's a scholar in this area, says that archaeologically speaking, you can tell when Christianity reached a city from how the sewer system was filled with the bones of dead babies. In the ancient world, there was this concept called patria potestas, the power of the father. He ruled with an iron fist. A father could imprison his son, scourge, shame, punish, sell him into slavery up to 3 times, or even kill him. The father had more power over his son than a master had over his slaves. This was the ancient world. Here's Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics. Now, what's interesting about him is he's an atheist. The title of his book, I don't know if you can see that, it's Bad Faith When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And here's what he writes on page 127. The church was the first institution to provide refuge for abandoned children. It is hard to overstate the impact of Jesus' teachings on the fate of children. This really is not debated. This is, when you read scholars on this, they have a one-voice, univocal opinion. This was really bad, and then Christians appeared on the scene to take care of the vulnerable, the most vulnerable among us. I hope you never read the Bible the same way. I hope you can look at these texts totally differently, knowing this cultural background. Do you remember that scene in Mark 10 where Jesus is going through Galilee, and one day some parents brought their children to Jesus so he could touch them and bless them? But the disciples scolded the parents for bothering him. Why would they do? I always read that. Why would the disciples care? The kids looked at Jesus like a jungle gym, right? They were just, oh, we can't wait to get around Jesus. He's fun. He's great. We want to be around him. But the disciples were looking at these kids like, you're subhuman. You're stupid. You're little. Get out of here. Get out of here. They scolded these kids. And when Jesus saw this, he was angry. Angry at whom? The parents? The kids? He was angry with his disciples. He said to them, let the children come to me. Don't stop them, for the kingdom of God belongs to those who are like these children. I tell you the truth. Anyone who doesn't receive the kingdom of God like a child will never enter it. I hate cats, okay? I hate them. I hate cats. For me, reading this would be like Jesus saying, I tell you the truth, anyone who doesn't receive the kingdom like a cat will never enter it. I would just be like, ooh, man, could you pick a better simile there? What about this? Patria potestas, power of the Father. And then you read from Paul, Colossians 3:21, fathers, not only do you not whip, beat, imprison, or kill your children, don't even embitter them. Fathers, don't discourage them. Ephesians 6, don't provoke your children to anger. Can you imagine? I mean, today we yawn at that. In the ancient world, they would have gasped. They wouldn't have been able to believe that ethic. What about the rights of women? Women's rights. Women's rights? Today, that rolls right off our tongue. In the ancient world, this was an oxymoron. This was a contradiction. It would be like saying a four-sided triangle. You know what I mean? It'd be like a married bachelor or, you know, a jumbo shrimp or country music. You know what I mean? I had to. Sorry. I hate it. I hate it. Women's rights? Women's rights. Women have rights? Again, they would have choked on this. For us, we gulp it right down. Of course there's women's rights, absolutely. Plutarch, first century, Spartan women, very liberated, were kept, quote, under lock and key. Aristotle, silence gives grace to woman. He's not the only one. People from the period, Sophocles, Euripides, O woman, silence is an adornment. Silence and discretion are most beautiful in women, and remain quiet within the house. Translation, stay at home and be quiet. That was the ancient world. Demosthenes, 4th century, we men have concubines for pleasure, female servants for our daily care, sex, and wives to give us legitimate children and to be guardians of our households. Everything was for the man in the ancient world. Latin, you can learn a lot by studying a language. The Latin language had 25 words for a prostitute. It didn't have a single word for a male virgin. Holland again. In Rome, men no more hesitated to use slaves and prostitutes to relieve themselves of their sexual needs than they did to use the side of the road as a toilet. In Latin, the same word meo meant both ejaculate and urinate. It was the same idea. It's a bodily process, nothing more. No moral content at all. Now imagine being in that world. Imagine being in that world. And you see this itinerant Jewish rabbi who has women whom he has healed, women whom he has taught, women who are his disciples. That wasn't okay in the Greco-Roman world. It wasn't okay in the Jewish world. Better for the words of the Torah to be burned than to be put into the hands of a woman. And here we have Jesus saying, women can follow me, never abused them, never harmed them, but taught them, loved them. Paul writing, there is no longer male and female. You're all one in Christ Jesus. How about this one? You probably skim right over this. All of you singles, you know who you are. You skim right over this. Because you're just like, oh, of course, I just date whoever I want, and then I, you know, get married to whoever I want, and there's free. Look at this. Look at this. 1 Corinthians 7:39, if a woman's husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, only in the Lord. Ancient people would be gone. You, Christian, you got to get your women under control. All right? These women, they're going to be going, they're going to be marrying whoever they want. And Paul would go, yeah, freedom, individualism, rights. How about this? 1 Peter 3:7. Treat your wife with understanding as you live together. She is your equal partner in God's new gift of life. They don't even go into this whole idea of concubines and female slaves and what. It's treat your wife with understanding as an equal. Husbands, love your wives and never treat them harshly. Husbands, love your wives. Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That is the standard to which Paul points. The way that Jesus loved sacrificially, fiercely. That love is the love that husbands have for their wives. Let me put it this way. If you were an ancient child or an ancient woman, you would pray that you would be in a Christian home. Of all the homes you could live in, you would pray, please get me into a Christian home. Therefore, is there any wonder that in the burgeoning Christian movement, there were twice as many women as there were men? 2/3, 1/3. Celsus, the critic of Christianity, argued with Origen, AD 250. Christianity. You just bring in all the women into your religion. Yes? Yes, we do. Women finally found dignity, personhood, and value in the Christian community. Women, what about slaves? The problem of slavery, again, that's a contradiction in terms to an ancient person. The problem of slavery, there was no problem. Nobody had a problem with slavery. The only two groups of people that had a problem with slavery were Christians and slaves. They were the only ones. Everyone else was just like, that's just the way it is. Of course, that's the way it is. Homer, 8th century, he says, Zeus takes away half of the worth of a man when the day of slavery comes upon him. Aristotle, a slave is a living tool. You know, like a power drill or a, you know, sledgehammer, right? Or a shovel. Philip said, those are inanimate tools. Those are tools that we use. But then there are living tools like people. Living tools and inanimate tools. Seneca, again, 1st century. We maltreat slaves, not as if they were men, but as if they were beasts of burden. He's lamenting this in the context. He's like, I don't like it. I don't know what to do with it. But he just follows right along with the zeitgeist of his age. This is just the way that it is. Now imagine being a slave in the ancient world. And you read this from Paul, 1 Timothy 1:9. Slave traders, andropodestai. Andros means man, podestai means foot. Maybe you went to the podiatrist, foot doctor. This either means you capture someone that's running away on foot, or as Colin Brown says, that you grab their foot. You lasso them to hunt them down and trade them as a slave. This term, slave traders, what are they called by Paul? Lawless and rebels. If the antebellum South in the United States had followed this one verse, slavery would have been toast. They weren't following the Bible too little. They were following it too much. Or rather, they weren't following it too much. They're following it too little. Yeah. Everyone goes, yeah, you got that wrong. Don't you love when you make a mistake in front of a couple thousand people? Anyways, if you can gain your freedom, do so. Do not become slaves of men, 1 Corinthians 7. There is no longer a slave or free, for you are all one in Christ Jesus, and this resounds throughout the writing of the New Testament. I heard one person say, well, Jesus never mentioned slavery. In Israel, slavery, being an ebed in Hebrew, totally different. However, Jesus did mention slavery. Luke 4, Jesus said, I have come to set the captives free. He did mention it. Slaves, and finally, the poor, the weak, and the sick. Here's one ancient philosopher from Rome, Plautus. He says, you do a poor beggar bad service by giving him food and drink. Okay. I know there's that tension of seeing someone who's begging and you say, should I give them money? Because this could go to substance abuse or God knows where. He's saying, not money, food, right? Drink, helping them to stay alive. Why is that a bad thing to do, Plaustus? You lose what you give, and you just prolong his life for more misery. That was the thinking in the ancient world. Here's Bart Ehrman, no friend of Christianity, an atheistic New Testament scholar, and he's arguing in this clip that dominance was the chief virtue in the ancient world. It led to the marginalization and dominance of babies, children, slaves, women, other towns, and even at the end, he says, the poor. See what you think of this.
The ideology was one of dominance, that a whoever was dominant, there were no ethical problems with a person who was dominating somebody. That's what they were supposed to do. And so you can read through the moral discourses of Romans and Greeks, and they don't problematize that. They don't problematize slavery. Of course, I mean, the master is supposed to be master of the slave, and so slavery is fine. Yeah, of course. They were usually prisoners of war in the ancient world. It wasn't a race thing. It's just, you know, you enslave people. And men were to dominate women economically, socially, culturally, politically, sexually. So it was all domination, and Jesus preached service. And it was completely contrary to what the dominant paradigm was that you're to serve others and to live for them and to help the poor. And that's when, you know, in the ancient world, the idea of helping the poor was like unheard of. It's like, are you kidding me? That's a joke. No, you're not going to help the poor. And so I completely agree with that is a paradigm shift.
Paradigm shift. You know, we call that an understatement right there. Jesus, his most repeated teachings, what were they? If you give your life away, that's how you keep it. If you want to be first, you need to be last. The greatest of all is the servant. Servant love. It's all throughout Jesus' ministry, repeated over and over and over again. Gary Ferngren writes this. He's an expert in hospitals, of all things. He says, the hospital was in origin and conception a distinctly Christian institution. There were no pre-Christian institutions in the ancient world that served the purpose that Christian hospitals were to serve. Now you say, wait a minute, so you're saying there was no medicine in the ancient world? No, there was medicine. There were no doctors in the ancient world? They're in the Bible. Luke was a doctor, Colossians 4. Serranus, Galen, they had doctors back in the ancient world. Why? Why were there doctors? They were there to get the troops mended up so they could go dominate other nations. That's what doctors were there for in the ancient world. The Hippocratic Oath, very noble, wonderful. Guess the people it doesn't apply to. Children. Children are never mentioned in the Hippocratic Oath. So this idea that you have these places where you take care of the poor, and the weak, and the sick, and the hurt, only because you love them. Only because they need the care. Where did they get that idea? One word. Jesus. Repeatedly, Jesus said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. This is how he inaugurates his ministry. To bring good news to the poor. When you have a banquet, who do you invite? Invite the poor, the disabled, the blind. Again, we read that, we just, in our Bible reading, just read right through it. Of course, course, you're supposed to help the poor. Of course, the marginalized, the hurting. In the ancient world, those were the outcasts. Sell your possessions and give it to the poor. In the ancient world, you would sell your possessions to buy a building, to create a coliseum, to get your name etched in the stone so that you could live on in memorandum forever. But Jesus said, no, you just give it for people, the poor. Human personhood, infants and children, women, slaves, the poor, the weak, and the sick. What are we supposed to do with all this? What are the implications for us today? First, do not be ashamed to be a follower of Jesus. I know in our world today, it's getting more and more difficult in many respects. I don't want to have a martyr complex or a persecution complex, but I know it has changed. It is different than it used to be, and it's getting harder. The world can do what the world's going to do, okay? Jesus himself said that at the end of the age, Matthew 24, most people's love will grow cold. So when the world is getting worse and worse and worse and worse, it's going to be at that exact same time that he says, this gospel of the kingdom will reach all nations, and then the end will come. Have you thought about that? Oh, we turn on the news and things are just, oh, terrible. The culture is falling apart. The Western world is falling apart. Did you know that Jesus predicted all of it? And he said, during those very conditions, more and more people are going to come to faith because they're going to live that life. It's a vague, gray life where you have no foundation for values, no foundation for purpose, nothing like that. And when you crash, you fall apart. And here, Jesus says, this is precisely the condition in which people come to faith in me. When they've burned out with road rash on everything else. Jesus Christ has been the greatest force for good in world history. Full stop, end of discussion. I will debate that with anybody on earth. Jesus Christ has been the best force for good in the world, period. Now, people will say, as Christians, you're regressive. You're judgmental. You're hypocritical. You're pushy. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm not, but maybe you are. You know? I have no interest in defending Christians. I have every interest in defending Christ. Christ is the one who inaugurated this revolution that has changed the world for good. Being a part of this, there is nothing better on earth to be a part of. It is an absolute honor to have our heads held high to say we are part of the greatest thing on planet Earth, the greatest thing that's ever happened, is happening, or ever will happen in the history of the universe. Second, beliefs have consequences. If you're here tonight and you're still figuring out your beliefs, I applaud you to coming out to a Christian conference. That's wonderful that you're so open-minded to hear what do Christians think, okay? But what I will say to you is this, and I hope this bothers you in a good way. I hope you walk out of here thinking, man, what that guy said really bugged me. How do you know your beliefs are true? And how do you know that they're good? You could say, well, I know that my beliefs are true. How do you know? Because your mom told you? Your culture told you. Maybe your favorite podcaster told you. Years ago, my friend and I were doing relief work across the globe, and there was this dog. And to call him mangy would be an understatement. He just kind of slithered in between everyone all week long. I looked at the face of that dog, just a godless, soulless little creature. Reminded me of a cat, okay? I could nail it down. It reminded me of a... I turned to our translator and I said, so are the dogs here, are they like your pets or are they like a nuisance? They'll never forget what he said. It was spine chilling, okay? He said, oh, no, we love our dogs. We love them for dinner. And then he let out this shrill staccato laugh. And me and my buddy were like, ah. We were like, is he joking? I still don't know. That was 10 years ago. That was 2013. I still have no idea whether he's joking or not. Here's the thing. I would never eat a pet. Neither would you. And you would never eat a dog, right? You would never do that. Why? You know, in that culture, they do that. In our culture, we don't. Why? We have certain cultural assumptions that you've just kind of imbibed from the culture, but you really don't know why. There's no foundation. There's no reason why. In the same way, if you went and talked to Plato and you said, people are equal, Plato would look at you. And Plato was a kind of a smart man, you know? He would look at you and say, why do you believe that? If you don't have a good answer to that question, that there is a transcendent, infinite, personal God that loves every individual person, if you don't have a good foundation for that, how do you know your beliefs are even true? And how do you know that they're good? Third and finally, what was the message that changed the entire world? The message was this, very, very counterintuitive. Of everything I've said so far, this is the most counterintuitive. It was this. God was crucified. God was crucified. About a month ago, we were on vacation playing pickup basketball, you know, out away from our house. And this guy walked up and he wanted to play. And we played a couple games and then we sat down and we're drinking Gatorade, talking, and had a great spiritual conversation, and I got to share my views, and he shared his views, and it went on and on. And in the end, he said, you know, James, he said, I think about this, and I believe that Jesus existed. And I believe, you know, historians would say that he died on the cross, but the thing that just keeps nagging at me is what if the disciples wrote about all this, and they just made a big joke out of it? You know, just to fool everybody. A crucified guy is really the king of the universe. And maybe they made a joke out of it. And normally, I'm not very good in these situations, but this thought popped into my head. And I said, so-and-so, if they were trying to write a joke, the punchline would not be a crucifixion victim. Jesus hung from the cross, bleeding, butchered, in agony, in pain, naked, in front of, you know, the loincloth? That's for our benefit. In the ancient world, they were strung up, butchered like an animal, naked. What was he doing there? What was he doing, butchered on a cross, dying, losing his life? What was he doing there in agony for those hours on a Friday? In every other religion, you've got God or the God saying, you suffer and I'll watch. Okay? You go and figure it out on your own and I'll stay away from you. In Christianity, we have God entering into our world, not just entering as a king, but entering as a boy in a little manger, swinging a hammer until he was 30, being persecuted, whipped, beaten, and bludgeoned, and finally killed. What do you do with that? What do you do with that? The ancient world looked at that in two ways. 1 Corinthians 1:23 says that the Greeks looked at that as foolishness. And the Jews, they looked at that as a scandal. But that was the very message that changed the entire globe. That the highest God became the lowest. That the greatest king became the greatest servant. That the one who deserves all love and adoration took on the shame and the guilt of us all. in that message turned the world upside down.